was in a play, a production called The Maldivian Dodo, about two brothers, both ornithologists, one of whom is slowly tipping into an uncategorizable madness. The two of them had a late dinner every Thursday night for the entire run of the play, which he saw, as he has with all of Willem's plays, multiple times. On his third viewing, he spotted J.B. with Oliver, just a few rows ahead of him, but on the left side of the theater, and throughout the show he kept glancing over at J.B. to see if he was laughing at or concentrating on the same lines, aware that this was the first of Willem's productions that the three of them hadn't seen together, as a group, at least once. "So listen," Willem says, as they move down Fifth Avenue, which is empty of people, just bright-lit windows and stray bits of garbage twirling in the light, soft breeze, plastic bags puffed up with air into jellyfish and twists of newspaper. "I told Robin I'd talk to you about something." He waits. He has been conscious of not making the same mistake with Robin and Willem that he made with Philippa and Willem. When Willem asks him to accompany them anywhere, he makes sure that he's cleared it with Robin first. Finally, Willem had told him to stop asking, that Robin knew how much he meant to him, and she was fine with it. And if she wasn't fine with it, she'd have to get fine with it. And he has tried to present himself to Robin as someone independent and not likely to move in with them when he's old. He's not sure exactly how to communicate this message, however, and so is therefore unsure if he's been successful or not. But he likes Robin. She's a classics professor at Columbia who was hired to serve as a consultant on the films 2 years ago, and she has a spiky sense of humor that reminds him of J.B. somehow. "Okay," says Willem, and takes a deep breath, and he steadies himself. "Oh no," he thinks. "Do you remember Robin's friend Clara?" "Sure," he says. "The one I met at Clementine." "Yes," says Willem, triumphantly. "That's her." "God, Willem, give me some credit. It was just last week." "I know, I know. Well, anyway, here's the thing. She's interested in you." He is perplexed. "What do you mean?" "She asked Robin if you were single." He pauses. "I told her I didn't think you were interested in seeing anyone, but I'd ask. So, I'm asking." The idea is so preposterous that it takes him a while to understand what Willem's saying, and when he does, he stops and laughs, embarrassed and disbelieving. "You've got to be kidding, Willem," he says. "That's ridiculous." "Why is it ridiculous?" asks Willem, suddenly serious. "Jude, why?" "Willem," he says, recovering himself, "it's very flattering, but—" He winces and laughs again. "It's absurd." "What is?" Willem says, and he can feel the conversation turn. "That someone should be attracted to you? This isn't the first time this has happened, you know. You just can't see it because you won't let yourself." He shakes his head. "Let's talk about something else, Willem." "No," says Willem. "You're not getting out of this one, Jude. Why is it ridiculous? Why is it absurd?" He is suddenly so uncomfortable that he actually does stop right on the corner of 5th and 45th and starts scanning the avenue for a cab. But of course, there are no cabs. As he considers how to respond, he thinks back to a time a few days after that night in J.B.'s apartment when he had asked Willem if J.B. had been correct, at least in some part. Did Willem resent him? Did he not tell them enough? Willem had been silent for such a long time that he knew the answer even before he heard it. "Look, Jude," Willem had said, slowly. J.B. was out of his mind. I could never be sick of you. You don't owe me your secrets." He paused. "But yes, I do wish you'd share more of yourself with me. Not so I could have the information, but so maybe I could be of some help." He stopped and looked at him. "That's all." Since then, he has tried to tell Willem more things, but there are so many topics that he has never discussed with anyone since Anna, now 25 years ago, that he finds he literally doesn't have the language to do so. His past, his fears, what was done to him, what he has done to himself, They are subjects that can only be discussed in tongues he doesn't speak. Farsi, Urdu, Mandarin, Portuguese. Once, he tried to write some things down, thinking that it might be easier, but it wasn't. He is unclear how to explain himself to himself. You'll find your own way to discuss what happened to you, he remembers Anna saying. You'll have to, if you ever want to be close to anyone. He wishes, as he often does, that he had let her talk to him, that he had let her teach him how to do it. His silence had begun as something protective, but over the years it has transformed into something near oppressive, something that manages him rather than the other way around. Now he cannot find a way out of it, even when he wants to. He imagines he is floating in a small bubble of water, encased on all sides by walls and ceilings and floors of ice, all many feet thick. He knows there is a way out, but he is unequipped. He has no tools to begin his work, and his hands scrabble uselessly against the ice's slick. He had thought that by not saying who he was making himself more palatable, less strange. But now, what he doesn't say makes him stranger, an object of pity and even suspicion. Jude, Willem prompts him. Why is it absurd? He shakes his head. It just is. He starts walking again. For a block, they say nothing. Then Willem asks, Jude, do you ever want to be with someone? I never thought I would. But that's not what I asked. I don't know, Willem, he says, unable to look at Willem's face. I guess I just don't think that sort of thing is for someone like me. What does that mean? He shakes his head again, not saying anything, but Willem persists. Because you have some health problems? Is that why? Health problems, says something sour and sardonic inside him. Now that's a euphemism. But he doesn't say this out loud. Willem, he pleads, I'm begging you to stop talking about this. We've had such a good night. It's our last night, and then I'm not going to see you. Can we please change the subject, please? Willem doesn't say anything for another block, and he thinks the moment has passed. But then Willem says, You know, when we first started going out, Robin asked me whether you were gay or straight, and I had to tell her I didn't know. He pauses. She was shocked. She kept saying, This is your best friend since you guys were teenagers and you don't know? Philippa used to ask me about you as well, and I'd tell her the same thing I told Robin, that you're a private person, and I've always tried to respect your privacy. But I guess this is the kind of stuff I wish you'd tell me, Jude. Not so I can do anything with the information, but just because it gives me a better sense of who you are. I mean, maybe you're neither. Maybe you're both. Maybe you're just not interested. It doesn't make a difference to me. He doesn't. He can't say anything in response. And they walk another two blocks, 38th Street, 37th Street. He is conscious of his right foot dragging against the pavement the way it does when he is tired or dispirited, too tired or dispirited to make a greater effort, and is grateful that Willem is on his left, and therefore less likely to notice it. I worry sometimes that you've decided to convince yourself that you're somehow unattractive or unlovable, and that you've decided that certain experiences are off-limits for you. But they're not, Jude. Anyone would be lucky to be with you, says Willem a block later. Enough of this, he thinks. He can tell by Willem's tone that he is building up to a longer speech, and he is now actively anxious, his heart beating a funny rhythm. Willem, he says, turning to him, I think I'd better take a taxi after all. I'm getting tired. I'd better go to bed. Jude, come on, says Willem, with enough impatience in his voice that he flinches. Look, I'm sorry, but really, Jude, you can't just leave when I'm trying to talk to you about something important. This stops him. You're right, he says. I'm sorry. And I'm grateful, Willem. Really, I am. But this is just too difficult for me to discuss. Everything's too difficult for you to discuss, says Willem. And he flinches again. Willem sighs. I'm sorry.
I always keep thinking that someday I'm going to talk to you, really talk to you, and then I never do, because I'm afraid you're going to shut down, and then you won't talk to me at all.
They are silent, and he is chastened, because he knows Willem is right. That is exactly what he'd do. A few years ago, Willem had tried to talk to him about his cutting. They had been walking then, too, and after a certain point, the conversation had become so intolerable that he had hailed a cab and frantically pulled himself in, leaving Willem standing on the sidewalk, calling his name in disbelief. He had cursed himself even as the car sped south. Willem had been furious. He had apologized. They had made up. But Willem has never initiated that conversation again, and neither has he.
But tell me this, Jude. Are you ever lonely?
No, he says, finally. A couple walks by, laughing, and he thinks of the beginning of their walk when they too were laughing. How has he managed to ruin this night, the last time he will see Willem for months?
You don't need to worry about me, Willem. I'll always be fine. I'll always be able to take care of myself.
And then Willem sighs and sags and looks so defeated that he feels a twist of guilt. But he is also relieved because he senses that Willem doesn't know how to continue the conversation, and he will soon be able to redirect him and end the evening pleasantly and escape.
You always say that. Because it's always true.
There is a long, long silence. They are standing in front of a Korean barbecue restaurant, and the air is dense and fragrant with steam and smoke and roasting meat.
Can I go?
He asks finally, and Willem nods. He goes to the curb and raises his arm, and a cab glides to his side. Willem opens the door for him, and then, as he's getting in, puts his arm around him and holds him. And he finally does the same.
I'm going to miss you,
Willem says into the back of his neck.
Are you going to take care of yourself while I'm gone?
Yes, he says.
I promise.
He steps back and looks at him.
Until November, then.
Willem makes a face that's not quite a smile.
November,
he echoes. In the cab, he finds he really is tired, and he leans his forehead against the greased window and closes his eyes. By the time he reaches home, he feels as leaden as a corpse, and in the apartment, he starts taking off his clothes, shoes, sweater, shirt, undershirt, pants, as soon as he's locked the door behind him, leaving them littering the floor in a trail as he makes his way to the bathroom. His hands tremor as he unsticks the bag from beneath the sink, and although he hadn't thought he'd need to cut himself that night, nothing that day or early evening had indicated he might, he is almost ravenous for it now. He has long ago run out of blank skin on his forearms, and he now recuts over old cuts, using the edge of the razor to saw through the tough, webby scar tissue. When the new cuts heal, they do so in warty furrows, and he is disgusted and dismayed and fascinated all at once by how severely he has deformed himself. Lately, he has begun using the cream that Andy gave him for his back on his arms, and he thinks it helps, a bit. The skin feels looser, the scars a little softer and more supple. The shower area Malcolm has created in this bathroom is enormous, so large he now sits within it when he's cutting, his legs stretched out before him, and after he's done, he's careful to wash away the blood because the floor is a great plain of marble. And as Malcolm has told him again and again, once you stain marble, there's nothing that can be done. And then he is in bed, lightheaded but not quite sleepy, staring at the dark, mercury-like gleam the chandelier makes in the shadowy room.
I'm lonely, he says aloud,
and the silence of the apartment absorbs the words like blood soaking into cotton. This loneliness is a recent discovery, and is different from the other loneliness he has experienced. It is not the childhood loneliness of not having parents, or of lying awake in a motel room with Brother Luke, trying not to move, not to rouse him, while the moon threw hard white stripes of light across the bed. or of the time he ran away from the home, the successful time, and spent the night wedged into the cleft of an oak tree's buckling roots that spread open like a pair of legs, making himself as small as he could. He had thought he was lonely then, but now he realizes that what he was feeling was not loneliness, but fear. But now he has nothing to fear. Now he has protected himself. He has this apartment with its triple locked doors, and he has money. He has parents, he has friends. He will never again have to do anything he doesn't want to for food, or transportation, or shelter, or escape. He hadn't been lying to Willem. He is not meant for a relationship, and has never thought he was. He has never envied his friends theirs. To do so would be akin to a cat coveting a dog's bark. It is something that would never occur to him to envy, because it is impossible, something that is simply alien to his very species. But recently, people have been behaving as if it is something he could have, or should want to have, and although he knows they mean it in part as a kindness, it feels like a taunt. They could be telling him he could be a decathlete, and it would be as obtuse and as cruel. He expects it from Malcolm and Harold. Malcolm because he is happy and sees a single path, his path, to happiness, and so therefore occasionally asks him if he can set him up with someone, or if he wants to find someone, then is bewildered when he declines. Harold because he knows that the part of the parental role Harold most enjoys is inserting himself into his life and rooting about in it as best as he can. He has grown to enjoy this, too, sometimes. He is touched that someone is interested enough in him to order him around, to be disappointed by the decisions he makes, to have expectations for him, to assume the responsibility of ownership of him. 2 years ago, he and Harold were at a restaurant, and Harold was giving him a lecture about how his job at Rosen Pritchard had made him essentially an accessory to corporate malfeasance, when they both realized that their waiter was standing above them, holding his pad before him. "Pardon me," said the waiter. "Should I come back?" "No, don't worry," Harold said, picking up his menu. "I'm just yelling at my son, but I can do that after we order." The waiter had given him a commiserating smile, and he had smiled back, thrilled to have been claimed as another's in public, to finally be a member of the tribe of sons and daughters. Later, Harold had resumed his rant, and he had pretended to be upset, but really, he had been happy the entire night, contentment saturating his every cell, smiling so much that Harold had finally asked him if he was drunk. But now Harold, too, has started to ask him questions. "This is a terrific place," he said when he was in town the previous month for the birthday dinner he'd commanded Willem not to throw for him, and which Willem had done anyway. Harold had stopped by the apartment the next day, and as he always did, rambled about it admiringly, saying the same things he always did. "This is a terrific place. It's so clean in here. Malcolm did such a good job. And lately, it's massive, though, Jude. Don't you get lonely in here by yourself?" "No, Harold," he said. "I like being alone." Harold had grunted.
"Willem seems happy," he said. "Robin seems like a nice girl."
"She is," he said, making Harold a cup of tea. "And I think he is happy."
"Jude, don't you want that for yourself?" Harold asked.
He sighed. "No, Harold, I'm fine."
"Well, what about me and Julia?" asked Harold. "We'd like to see you with someone."
"You know I want to make you and Julia happy," he said, trying to keep his voice level. "But I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to help you on this front. Here," he gave Harold his tea. Sometimes he wonders whether this very idea of loneliness is something he would feel at all had he not been awakened to the fact that he should be feeling lonely, that there is something strange and unacceptable about the life he has. Always there are people asking him if he misses what it had never occurred to him to want, never occurred to him he might have. Harold and Malcolm, of course, but also Richard, whose girlfriend, a fellow artist named India, has all but moved in with him, and people he sees less frequently as well,
Citizen and Elijah and Phaedra and even Kerrigan, his old colleague from Judge Sullivan's chambers, who had looked him up a few months ago when he was in town with his husband. Some of them ask him with pity, and some ask him with suspicion. The first group feels sorry for him because they assume his singlehood is not his decision, but a state imposed upon him. And the second group feels a kind of hostility for him, because they think that singlehood is his decision, a defiant violation of a fundamental law of adulthood. Either way, being single at 40 is different from being single at 30, and with every year it becomes less understandable, less enviable, and more pathetic, more inappropriate. For the past 5 years, he has attended every partner's dinner alone, and a year ago, when he became an equity partner, he attended the partner's annual retreat alone as well. The week before the retreat, Lucian had come into his office one Friday night and sat down to review the week's business, as he often did. They talked about the retreat, which was going to be in Anguilla, which the two of them genuinely dreaded, unlike the other partners, who pretended to dread it, but actually, he and Lucian agreed, were looking forward to it.
"Is Meredith coming?" he asked.
"She is." There was a silence, and he knew what was coming next. "Are you bringing anyone?"
"No,"
he said. Another silence, in which Lucian stared at the ceiling.
"You've never brought anyone to one of these events, have you?"
asked Lucian, his voice carefully casual.
"No,"
he said, and then, when Lucian didn't say anything,
"Are you trying to tell me something, Lucian?"
"No, of course not," Lucian said, looking back at him. "This isn't the sort of firm where we keep track of those kinds of things, Jude. You know that." He had felt a flush of anger and embarrassment.
"Except it clearly is. If the management committee is saying something, Lucian, you have to tell me."
"Jude," said Lucian, "we're not. You know how much everyone here respects you. I just think, and this is not the firm talking, just me, that I'd like to see you settle down with someone."
"Okay, Lucian, thanks," he'd said, wearily. "I'll take that under advisement."
But as self-conscious as he is about appearing normal, he doesn't want a relationship for propriety's sake. He wants it because he has realized he is lonely. He is so lonely that he sometimes feels it physically, a sodden clump of dirty laundry pressing against his chest. He cannot unlearn the feeling. People make it sound so easy, as if the decision to want it is the most difficult part of the process. But he knows better. Being in a relationship would mean exposing himself to someone, which he has still never done to anyone but Andy. It would mean the confrontation of his own body, which he has not seen unclothed in at least a decade. Even in the shower, he doesn't look at himself. And it would mean having sex with someone, which he hasn't done since he was 15, which he dreads so completely that the thought of it makes his stomach fill with something waxy and cold. When he first started seeing Andy, Andy would occasionally ask him if he was sexually active, until he finally told Andy that he would tell him when and if it ever happened. And until then, Andy could stop asking him. So Andy never asked again, and he has never had to volunteer the information. Not having sex. It was one of the best things about being an adult. But as much as he fears sex, he also wants to be touched. He wants to feel someone else's hands on him, although the thought of that too terrifies him. Sometimes he looks at his arms and is filled with a self-hatred so fiery that he can barely breathe. Much of what his body has become has been beyond his control, but his arms have been all his doing, and he can only blame himself. When he had begun cutting himself, he had cut on his legs, just the calves, and before he learned to be organized about how he applied them, he swiped the blade across the skin in haphazard strokes, so it looked as if he had been scratched by a crosshatch of grasses. No one ever noticed. No one ever looks at a person's calves. Even Brother Luke hadn't bothered him about them. But now, no one could not notice his arms, or his back, or his legs, which are striped with runnels where damaged tissue and muscle have been removed,
and indentations the size of thumbprints, where the brace's screws had once been drilled through the flesh and into the bone, and satiny pawns of skin where he had sustained burns in the injury, and the places where his wounds have closed over, where the flesh now craters slightly, the area around them tinged a permanent dull bronze. When he has clothes on, he is one person, but when he is without them, he is revealed as he really is, the years of rot manifested on his skin, his own flesh advertising his past, its depravities and corruptions. Once, in Texas, one of his clients had been a man who was grotesque, so fat that his stomach had dropped into a pendant of flesh between his legs and covered everywhere with flows of eczema, the skin so dry that when he moved, small ghostly strips of it floated from his arms and back and into the air. He had been sickened seeing the man, and yet they all sickened him, and so, in a way, this man was no better or worse than the others. As he had given the man a blowjob, the man's stomach pressing against his neck, the man had cried, apologizing to him. I'm sorry, he said, the tips of his fingers on the top of his head. The man had long fingernails, each as thick as bone, and he dragged them over his scalp, but gently, as if they were tines of a comb. And somehow, it is as if over the years he has become that man, and he knows that if anyone were to see him, they too would feel repulsed, nauseated by his deformities. He doesn't want someone to have to stand before the toilet retching, as he had done afterward, scooping handfuls of liquid soap into his mouth, gagging at the taste, trying to make himself clean again. So he will never have to do anything he doesn't want to do for food and shelter. He finally knows that. But what is he willing to do to feel less alone? Could he destroy everything he's built and protected so diligently for intimacy? How much humiliation is he ready to endure? He doesn't know. He is afraid of discovering the answer. But increasingly, he is even more afraid that he will never have the chance to discover it at all. What does it mean to be a human if he can never have this? And yet, he reminds himself, loneliness is not hunger, or deprivation, or illness. It is not fatal. Its eradication is not owed him. He has a better life than so many people, a better life than he had ever thought he would have. To wish for companionship along with everything else he has seems a kind of greed, a gross entitlement. The weeks pass. Willem's schedule is erratic, and he calls him at odd hours, at 1 in the morning, at 3 in the afternoon. He sounds tired, but it isn't in Willem's nature to complain, and he doesn't. He tells him about the scenery, the archaeological sites they've been given permission to shoot in, the little mishaps on set. When Willem is away, he's increasingly inclined to stay indoors and do nothing, which he knows isn't healthy, and so he has been vigilant about filling his weekends with events, with parties and dinners. He goes to museum shows and to plays with Black Henry Young and to galleries with Richard. Felix, whom he tutored so long ago, now helms a punk band called the Quiet Americans, and he makes Malcolm come with him to their show. He tells Willem about what he's seen and what he's read, about conversations with Harold and Julia, about Richard's latest project and his clients at the nonprofit, about Andy's daughter's birthday party and Phaedra's new job, about people he's talked to and what they've said. 5.5 more months, Willem says at the end of one conversation. 5.5 more, he repeats. That Thursday he goes to dinner at Rhodes's new apartment, which is near Malcolm's parents' house, and which Rhodes had told him over drinks in December is the source of all his nightmares. He wakes at night with ledgers scrolling through his mind, the stuff of his life, tuition, mortgages, maintenances, taxes, reduced to terrifyingly large figures. "And this is with my parents' help," he'd said. "And Alex wants to have another kid. I'm 45, Jude, and I'm already beat. I'm going to be working until I'm 80 if we have a third." Tonight, He is relieved to see Rhodes seems more relaxed, his neck and cheeks pink. "Christ," Rhodes says, "how do you stay so thin year after year?" When they had met at the U.S. Attorney's Office 15 years ago, Rhodes had still looked like a lacrosse player, all muscle and sinew. But since joining the bank, he has thickened, grown abruptly old. "I think the word you're looking for is scrawny," he tells Rhodes. Rhodes laughs. "I don't think so," he says, "but I'd take scrawny at this point." There are 11 people at dinner, and Rhodes has to retrieve his desk chair from his office and the bench from Alex's dressing room. He remembers this about Rhodes's dinners. The food is always perfect, there are always flowers on the table, and yet something always goes wrong with the guest list and the seating. Alex invites someone she's just met and forgets to tell Rhodes, or Rhodes miscounts, and what is intended as a formal, organized event becomes instead chaotic and casual. "Shit," Rhodes says, as he always does, but he's always the only one who minds. Alex is seated to his left, and he talks to her about her job as the public relations director of a fashion label called Rothko, which she has just quit, to Rhodes's consternation. "Do you miss it yet?" he asks. "Not yet," she says. "I know Rhodes isn't happy about it," she smiles, "but he'll get over it. I just felt I should stay home while the kids are young." He asks about the country house the two of them have bought in Connecticut, another source of Rhodes's nightmares, and she tells him about the renovation, which is grinding into its third summer, and he groans in sympathy. "Rhodes said you were looking somewhere in Columbia County," she says. "Did you end up buying?" "Not yet," he says. It had been a choice. Either the house, or he and Richard were going to renovate the ground floor, make the garage usable, and add a gym and a small pool, one with a constant current so you could swim in place in it. And in the end, he chose the renovation. Now he swims every morning in complete privacy. Not even Richard enters the gym area when he's in it. "We wanted to wait on the house, actually," Alex admits. "But really, we didn't have a choice. We wanted the kids to have a yard while they were little." He nods. He has heard this story before from Rhodes. Often it feels as if he and Rhodes, and he and almost every one of his contemporaries at the firm, are living parallel versions of adulthood. Their world is governed by children, little despots whose needs, school and camp and activities and tutors, dictate every decision, and will for the next 10, 15, 18 years. Having children has provided their adulthood with an instant and non-negotiable sense of purpose and direction. They decide the length and location of that year's vacation. They determine if there will be any leftover money, and if so, how it might be spent. They give shape to a day, a week, a year, a life. Children are a kind of cartography, and all one has to do is obey the map they present to you on the day they are born. But he and his friends have no children, and in their absence, the world sprawls before them, almost stifling in its possibilities. Without them, one's status as an adult is never secure. A childless adult creates adulthood for himself, and as exhilarating as it often is, it is also a state of perpetual insecurity, of perpetual doubt. Or it is to some people. Certainly it is to Malcolm, who recently reviewed with him a list he'd made in favor of and against having children with Sophie, much as he had when he was deciding whether to marry Sophie in the first place 4 years ago. "I don't know, Mal," he said, after listening to Malcolm's list. "It sounds like the reasons for having them are because you feel you should, not because you really want them." "Of course I feel I should," said Malcolm. "Don't you ever feel like we're all basically still living like children, Jude?" "No," he said. And he never had. His life was as far from his childhood as he could imagine. "That's your dad talking, Mal. Your life won't be any less valid or any less legitimate if you don't have kids." Malcolm had sighed. "Maybe," he said. "Maybe you're right." He'd smiled. "I mean, I don't really want them." He smiled back. "Well," he said, "you can always wait.
Maybe someday you can adopt a sad 30-year-old.
Maybe, Malcolm said again.
After all, I hear it is a trend in certain parts of the country.
Now Alex excuses herself to help Rhodes in the kitchen, who has been calling her name with mounting urgency.
Alex! Alex! Alex!
And he turns to the person on his right, whom he doesn't recognize from Rhodes's other parties, a dark-haired man with a nose that looks like it's been broken. It starts heading decisively in one direction before reversing directions, just as decisively right below the bridge.
Caleb Porter.
Jude St. Francis.
Let me guess. Catholic.
Let me guess. Not.
Caleb laughs. You're right about that. They talk, and Caleb tells him he's just moved to the city from London, where he spent the past decade as the president of a fashion label, to take over as the new CEO at Rothko. Alex very sweetly and spontaneously invited me yesterday, and I thought, he shrugs,
why not?
It's this, a good meal with nice people, or sitting in a hotel room looking desultorily at real estate listings. From the kitchen there is a timpani clatter of falling metal, and Rhodes swearing. Caleb looks at him, his eyebrows raised, and he smiles.
Don't worry, he reassures him. This always happens.
Over the remainder of the meal, Rhodes makes attempts to corral his guests into a group conversation, but it doesn't work. The table is too wide, and he has unwisely seated friends near each other, and so he ends up talking to Caleb. He is 49 and grew up in Marin County and hasn't lived in New York since he was in his 30s. He, too, went to law school, although he says he's never used a day of what he learned at work.
Never? He asks.
He is always skeptical when people say that. He is skeptical of people who claim law school was a colossal waste, a 3-year mistake. Although he also recognizes that he is unusually sentimental about law school, which gave him not only his livelihood, but in many ways, his life.
Caleb thinks.
Well, maybe not never, but not in the way you'd expect, he finally says. He has a deep, careful, slow voice, at once soothing and somehow slightly menacing. The thing that actually has ended up being useful is, of all things, civil procedure.
Do you know anyone who's a designer?
No, he says, but I have a lot of friends who are artists.
Well then, you know how differently they think. The better the artist, the higher the probability that they'll be completely unsuited for business. And they really are. I've worked at 5 houses in the past 20-odd years, and what's fascinating is witnessing the patterns of behavior. The refusal to hew to deadlines, the inability to stay within budget, the near incompetence when it comes to managing a staff, that are so consistent, you begin to wonder if lacking these qualities is something that's a prerequisite to having the job, or whether the job itself encourages these sorts of conceptual gaps. So what you have to do, in my position, is construct a system of governance within the company and then make sure it's enforceable and punishable. I'm not quite sure how to explain it. You can't tell them that it's good business to do one thing or another. That means nothing to them, or at least to some of them, as much as they say they understand it. You have to instead present it as the bylaws of their own small universe, and convince them that if they don't follow these rules, their universe will collapse. As long as you can persuade them of this, you can get them to do what you need. It's completely maddening.
So why do you keep working with them?
Because they do think so differently. It's fascinating to watch. Some of them are essentially subliterate. You get notes from them, and they can really barely construct a sentence. But then you watch them sketching or draping or just putting colors together, and it's, I don't know, it's wondrous. I can't explain it any better than that.
No, I know exactly what you mean, he says, thinking of Richard and J.B. and Malcolm and Willem. It's as if you're being allowed entree into a way of thinking you don't even have language to imagine, much less articulate.
That's exactly right, Caleb says, and smiles at him for the first time.
The dinner winds down, and as everyone's drinking coffee, Caleb disentangles his legs from under the table.
I'm going to head off, he says.
I think I'm still on London time, but it was a pleasure meeting you.
You too, he says.
I really enjoyed it.
And good luck establishing a system of civil governance within Rothko.
Thanks, I'll need it, says Caleb. And then, as he's about to stand, he stops and says, Would you like to have dinner sometime?
For a moment, he is paralyzed, but then he rebukes himself. He has nothing to fear. Caleb has just moved back to the city. He knows how difficult it must be to find someone to talk to, how difficult it is to find friends when, in your absence, all your friends have started families and are strangers to you. It is talking, nothing more.
That'd be great, he says, and he and Caleb exchange cards.
Don't get up, Caleb says as he starts to rise. I'll be in touch.
He watches as Caleb, who is taller than he had thought, at least 2 inches taller than he is, with a powerful-looking back, rumbles his goodbyes to Alex and Rhodes, and then leaves without turning around. He gets a message from Caleb the following day, and they schedule a dinner for Thursday. Late in the afternoon, he calls Rhodes to thank him for dinner and ask him about Caleb.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't even speak to him, Rhodes says. Alex invited him very last minute. This is exactly what I'm talking about with these dinner parties. Why is she inviting someone who's taking over at a company she's just leaving?
So you don't know anything about him?
Nothing.
Alex says he's well-respected and that Rothko fought hard to bring him back from London.
But that's all I know.
Why?
He can almost hear Rhodes smiling.
Don't tell me you're expanding your client base from the glamorous world of securities and pharma.
That's exactly what I'm doing, Rhodes, he says. Thanks again. And tell Alex thanks as well.
Thursday arrives, and he meets Caleb at an izakaya in West Chelsea. After they've ordered, Caleb says, You know, I was looking at you all through that dinner and trying to remember where I knew you from. And then I realized it was a painting by Jean-Baptiste Marion. The creative director at my last company owned it. Actually, he tried to make the company pay for it, but that's a different story. It's a really tight image of your face, and you're standing outside. You can see a streetlight behind you.
Right, he says.
This has happened to him a few times before, and he always finds it unsettling.
I know exactly the one you mean. It's from Seconds, Minutes, Hours, Days, the third series.
That's right, says Caleb, and smiles at him.
Are you and Marion close?
Not so much anymore, he says,
and as always, it hurts him to admit it.
But we were college roommates. I've known him for years.
It's a great series, Caleb says, and they talk about JB's other work and Richard, whose work Caleb also knows, an Asian Henry Young, and about the paucity of decent Japanese restaurants in London, and about Caleb's sister, who lives in Monaco with her second husband and their huge brood of children, and about Caleb's parents, who died after long illnesses when he was in his 30s, and about the house in Bridgehampton that Caleb's law school classmate is letting him use this summer while he's in L.A. And then there is enough talk of Rosen Pritchard and the financial mess that Rothko has been left in by the departing CEO to convince him that Caleb is looking not just for a friend, but potentially for representation as well, and he starts thinking about who at the firm should be responsible for the company. He thinks, I should give this to Evelyn, who is one of the young partners the firm nearly lost the previous year to, in fact, a fashion house where she would have been their in-house counsel. Evelyn would be good for this account. She is smart and she is interested in the industry, and it would be a good match. He is thinking this when Caleb abruptly asks, Are you single? And then laughing, Why are you looking at me like that?
Sorry, he says, startled, but smiling back. I am, yes, but I was just having this very conversation with my friend.
And what did your friend say?
He said,
he begins, but then stops, embarrassed and confused by the sudden shift of topic, of tone.
Nothing, he says,
and Caleb smiles, almost as if he has actually recounted the conversation, but doesn't press him.
He thinks then how he will make this evening into a story to tell Willem, especially this most recent exchange. "You win, Willem," he'll say to him, and if Willem tries to bring up the subject again, he decides he'll let him, and that this time he won't evade his questions. He pays and they walk outside where it is raining, not heavily, but steadily enough so that there are no cabs, and the streets gleam like licorice. "I have a car waiting," Caleb says. "Can I drop you somewhere?" "You don't mind?" "Not at all." The car takes them downtown, and by the time they've reached Green Street, it's pouring, so hard that they can no longer discern shapes through the window, just colors, spangles of red and yellow lights, the city reduced to the honking of horns and the clatter of rain against the roof of the car, so loud that they can barely hear each other over the din. They stop, and he's about to get out, when Caleb tells him to wait. He has an umbrella, and will walk him into the building, and before he can object, Caleb is getting out and unsnapping an umbrella, and the two of them huddle beneath it and into the lobby, the door thudding shut behind him, leaving them standing in the darkened entryway. "This is a hell of a lobby," Caleb says, dryly, looking up at the bare bulb. "Although it does have a sort of end-of-empire chic." And he laughs, and Caleb smiles. "Does Rosen Pritchard know you're living in a place like this?" he asks, and then before he can answer, Caleb leans in and kisses him very hard, so that his back is pressed against the door, and Caleb's arms make a cage around him. In that moment, he goes blank, the world, his very self, erasing themselves. It has been a long, long time since anyone has kissed him, and he remembers the sense of helplessness he felt whenever it happened, and how Brother Luke used to tell him to just open his mouth and relax and do nothing. And now, out of habit and memory and the inability to do anything else, that is what he does, and waits for it to be over, counting the seconds and trying to breathe through his nose. Finally, Caleb steps back and looks at him, and after a while he looks back. And then Caleb does it again, this time holding his face between his hands, and he has that sensation he always had when he was a child and was being kissed, that his body was not his own, that every gesture he made was predetermined, reflex after reflex after reflex, and that he could do nothing but succumb to whatever might happen to him next. Caleb stops a second time and steps back again, looking at him and raising his eyebrows the way he had at Rhodes's dinner, waiting for him to say something. "I thought you were looking for legal representation," he says at last, and the words are so idiotic that he can feel his face get hot. But Caleb doesn't laugh. "No," he says. There is another long silence, and it is Caleb who speaks next. "Aren't you going to invite me up?" he asks. "I don't know," he says, and he wishes suddenly for Willem, although this is not the sort of problem that Willem has helped him with before, and in fact probably not the sort of problem that Willem would even consider a problem at all. He knows what a stolid, careful person he is, and although that stolidity and sense of caution guarantee he will never be the most interesting or provocative or glittery person in any gathering, in any room, they have protected him so far. They have given him an adulthood free of sordidness and filth. But sometimes he wonders whether he has insulated himself so much that he has neglected some essential part of being human. Maybe he is ready to be with someone. Maybe enough time has passed so it will be different. Maybe he is wrong. Maybe Willem is right. Maybe this isn't an experience that is forbidden to him forever. Maybe he is less disgusting than he thinks. Maybe he really is capable of this. Maybe he won't be hurt after all. Caleb seems, in that moment, to have been conjured, djinn-like, the offspring of his worst fears and greatest hopes, and dropped into his life as a test. On one side is everything he knows, the patterns of his existence as regular and banal as the steady plink of a dripping faucet, where he is alone but safe, and shielded from everything that could hurt him. On the other side are waves, tumult, rainstorms, excitement, everything he cannot control, everything potentially awful and ecstatic, everything he has lived his adult life trying to avoid, everything whose absence bleeds his life of color. Inside him, the creature hesitates, perching on its hind legs, pawing the air as if feeling for answers. Don't do it. Don't fool yourself. No matter what you tell yourself, you know what you are, says one voice. Take a chance, says the other voice. You're lonely. You have to try. That is the voice he always ignores. This may never happen again, the voice adds, and this stops him. It will end badly, says the first voice, and then both voices fall silent, waiting to see what he will do. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what will happen. He has to find out. Everything he has learned tells him to leave. Everything he has wished for tells him to stay. Be brave, he tells himself. Be brave for once. And so he looks back at Caleb. Let's go, he says. And although he is already frightened, he begins the long walk down the narrow hallway toward the elevator as if he is not. And along with the scrape of his right foot against the cement, he hears the tap of Caleb's footsteps and the explosions of rain pinging off the fire escape and the thrum of his own anxious heart. A year ago, he had begun working on a defense for a gigantic pharmaceutical company called Malgrave & Basket, whose board of directors was being sued by a group of their shareholders for malfeasance, incompetence, and neglect of their fiduciary duties. Gee, Lucian had said sarcastically, I wonder why they'd think that. He had sighed. I know, he said. Malgrave & Basket was a disaster, and everyone knew it. Over the previous few years, before they had come to Rose and Pritchard, the company had had to contend with two whistleblower lawsuits, one alleging that a manufacturing facility was dangerously out of date, the other that a different facility was producing contaminated products, had been served with subpoenas in connection with an investigation into an elaborate kickback scheme involving a chain of nursing homes, and had been alleged to be illegally marketing one of their best-selling drugs, which was approved only for treatment of schizophrenics, to Alzheimer's patients. And so he had spent the last 11 months interviewing 50 of Malgrave & Basket's current and former directors and officers and compiling a report to answer the lawsuit's claims. He had 15 other lawyers on his team. One night he overheard some of them referring to the company as malpractice and bastard. Don't you dare let the client hear you say that, he scolded them. It was late, 2 in the morning. He knew they were tired. If he had been Lucian, he would have yelled at them, but he was tired too. The previous week, another of the associates on the case, a young woman, had stood up from her desk at 3 a.m., looked around her, and collapsed. He had called an ambulance and sent everyone home for the night, as long as they returned by 9 a.m. He had stayed an hour longer and then had gone home himself. You let them go home and you stayed here? Asked Lucian the next day. You're getting soft, St. Francis. Thank God you don't act like this when you're at trial or we'd never get anywhere. If only opposing counsel knew what a pushover they were actually dealing with. So does this mean the firm isn't going to send poor Emma Gersh any flowers? Oh, we already sent them, said Lucian, getting up and wandering out of his office. Emma, get better. Get back here soon. Or else, love from your family at Rose & Pritchard. He loved going to trial. He loved arguing and speaking in a courtroom. You never got to do it enough. But his goal with Malgrave & Basket was to get the lawsuit tossed by a judge before it entered the grinding, tedious drone years of investigation and discovery. He wrote the motion to dismiss, and in early September, the district court judge threw out the suit. I'm proud of you, Lucian says that night. Malpractice and bastard don't know how fucking lucky they are. That suit was as solid as they come. Well, there's a lot that Malpractice and bastard don't seem to know, he says. True. But I guess you can be complete cretins as long as you have enough sense to hire the right lawyer. He stands. Are you going anywhere this weekend?
No.
We'll do something relaxing. Go outside, have a meal. You don't look too good.
Good night, Lucian.
Okay, okay. Good night. And congratulations. Really. This is a big one.
He stays at the office for another 2 hours, tidying and sorting papers, attempting to batten down the constant detritus. He feels no sense of relief or victory after these outcomes, just a tiredness, but a simple, well-earned tiredness, as if he has completed a day's worth of physical labor. 11 months. Interviews, research, more interviews, fact-checking, writing, rewriting, and then, in an instant, it is over, and another case will take its place. Finally, he goes home, where he is suddenly so exhausted that he stops on the way to his bedroom to sit on the sofa and wakes an hour later, disoriented and parched. He hasn't seen or talked to most of his friends in the past few months. Even his conversations with Willem have been briefer than usual. Part of this is attributable to malpractice and Bastard, and the frantic preparations they had demanded. But the other part is attributable to his ongoing confusion over Caleb, about whom he has not told Willem. This weekend, though, Caleb is in Bridgehampton, and he is glad of the time alone. He still doesn't know how he feels about Caleb, even 3 months later. He is not altogether certain that Caleb even likes him. Or rather, he knows he enjoys talking to him, but there are times when he catches Caleb looking at him with an expression that borders on disgust. "You're really handsome," Caleb once said, his voice perplexed, taking his chin between his fingers and turning his face toward him. But, and although he didn't finish, he could sense what Caleb wanted to say. "But something's wrong. But you still repel me. But I don't understand why I don't like you. Not really." He knows Caleb hates his walk, for example. A few weeks after they had started seeing each other, Caleb was sitting on the sofa, and he had gone to get a bottle of wine, and as he was walking back, he noticed Caleb staring at him so intently that he had grown nervous. He poured the wine, and they drank, and then Caleb said, "You know, when I met you, we were sitting down. So I didn't know you had a limp." "That's true," he said, reminding himself that this was not something for which he had to apologize. He hadn't entrapped Caleb. He hadn't intended to deceive him. He took a breath and tried to sound light, mildly curious. "Would you not have wanted to go out with me if you'd known?"
"I don't know," Caleb said after a silence. "I don't know."
He had wanted to vanish then, to close his eyes and reel back time, back to before he had ever met Caleb. He would have turned down Rhodes's invitation. He would have kept living his little life. He would have never known the difference. But as much as Caleb hates his walk, he loathes his wheelchair. The first time Caleb had come over in daylight, he had given him a tour of the apartment. He was proud of the apartment, and every day he was grateful to be in it, and disbelieving that it was his. Malcolm had kept Willem's suite, as they called it, where it had been, but had enlarged it and added an office at its northern edge, close to the elevator. And then there was the long, open space, with a piano and a living room area facing south, and a table that Malcolm had designed on the northern side, the side without windows, and behind it, a bookcase that covered the entire wall until the kitchen, hung with art by his friends and friends of friends, and other pieces that he had bought over the years. The whole eastern end of the apartment was his. You crossed from the bedroom on the north side through the closet and into the bathroom, which had windows that looked east and south. Although he mostly kept the shades in the apartment lowered, you could open them all at once, and the space would feel like a rectangle of pure light, the veil between you and the outside world mesmerizingly thin. He often feels as if the apartment is a falsehood. It suggests that the person within it is someone open and vital, and generous with his answers. And he, of course, is not that person. Lispenard Street,
with its half-obscured alcoves and dark warrens and walls that had been painted over so many times that you could feel ridges and blisters where moths and bugs had been entombed in its layers, was a much more accurate reflection of who he is. For Caleb's